Welcome to the PLOS Medicine podcast. I'm Claire Garvey, the Senior Research Editor of PLOS Medicine. In this podcast, you'll hear my interviews with the guest editors of our new special issue on the actionable cancer genome. First, you'll hear me speak with Elaine Mardis, who is the co-director of the McDonald Genome Institute at Washington University, where she is also the Robert E. and Louise F. Dan Distinguished Professor of Medicine. After Elaine, I will talk with Mark Ladagny, who is the Chief of Molecular Diagnostics Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Centre. If you'd like to submit to our special issue, go to plosmedicine.org and follow the link for the call for papers. Submissions close on Friday, July 8th. How has the investment in years of cancer genomics projects focused on sequencing paid off?
Well, I think the investment is paying off very handsomely. We, you know, have a wonderful and I think largely complete catalog of many of the variations that are identified in different tissue sites where cancer occurs in pediatric cancers and adult cancers and even in some rare tumor types. So, you know, this is really the foundational information that we need to now springboard into translational use of this information in the clinical setting of cancer care and diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. And what have been the catalysts or key factors, such as availability of the human genome sequence or a specific technology that have enabled large-scale cancer genomics and created the recent acceleration of clinical translation?
This has really been a confluence of a number of different technologies all emerging really coincidentally. So certainly next generation sequencing technology has been, I think, a key player, and the decreasing cost of generating that data has really accelerated the efforts extraordinarily. But without these two other key pieces of the puzzle, namely the human reference genome against which all of these next generation sequencing reads get aligned and then interpreted, and indeed the analytical software to really interpret that data, turn it into meaningful information about variants, where they lie, what types of genes are affected in which tissue sites, etc., you know, we really wouldn't have the ability to catalog all this information. So there's really been an explosion in terms of the bioinformatics and biostatistics aspects of tilling through all of these data that I think without that we would not have been as successful as we have been in getting such a nice catalog put together.
Has there been a specific technology that has driven the development of immunotherapies and neoantigen-developed targeting vaccines? Because certainly at the moment we've seen a lot of excitement in the immunotherapy area.
It is a very exciting time for immunotherapy, and of course that's a very broad term across which you can apply multiple modalities, including adaptive T-cell technologies, personalized vaccines, and then checkpoint blockade inhibition. So again, I think you're seeing a confluence of different approaches to immunotherapy that are really becoming more mature and much more successful through clinical trials and indeed FDA approval. The entry point for what we refer to as immunogenomics has actually been a little bit more recent, just with really within the last few years, where we've begun to realize that genomics can be a key indicator of the likelihood of response, some tumors being, you know, more loaded with mutations than others, shall we say, just by virtue of different etiologies and different mutagens being in the mix. So UV-induced melanomas and smoke carcinogen-associated cancers such as lung adenocarcinomas and bladder cancer, I think have all been widely recognized as being high mutation load and largely responsive to checkpoint blockade therapies. The personalized vaccines approach really requires genomics to define the neoantigens. And while we have good tools there, I would say that there's a considerable amount of development that's really still going to be required to perfect those approaches.
And what has characterized cancers that have been most responsive to targeted therapies?
What characterizes cancers that are responsive to targeted therapies at a first approximation is the presence of one or more key mutations. These are often affecting specific domains of the resulting protein, such as the tyrosine kinase domain. The mutations are referred to as activating, and they typically switch on the activity of that protein absent the normal phosphorylation or other signals. So while that's a preliminary indication of the likelihood of response to targeted therapies, we also know from large-scale clinical trials that it's not the only indication. So we don't know necessarily all the answers there in terms of what to look at. And then secondly, there is still some tissue site specificity. In other words, you may have the right mutation in the right gene, but that tissue may not respond due to other factors in terms of the program, the biology of the tissue that, you know, are really in play. So I think it's well understood, but not perfectly understood at this point.
And coming on to the point about immunotherapies, what's characterized those? Is it the high mutational burden?
Yes, typically right now today, we think that in general, patients with a germline susceptibility, such as a mismatch repair defect, these are the patients with really the sort of ultra mutator phenotype, as we call, and these are typically patients that are going to respond well to checkpoint blockade inhibition. And there are clinical trials that have been published in small numbers, but increasing numbers are ongoing right now to sort of shore that finding up. And then, of course, as I mentioned already, if you have a known carcinogen such as cigarette smoke or UV damage from sunlight exposure, these are also typically the tumors that will respond well to immunotherapy. Again, it's not a perfect equation. Most patients, but not all, have a response. And I think an interesting component of all of this is, what's the lowest, you know, mutation rate you can have and still have a response? So we understand high mutation load, but we really don't know sort of how low we can go.
Yeah, that's an interesting point.
Yeah.
How are researchers and clinicians approaching cancers that develop resistance to targeted therapies, such as lung cancer or melanoma?
Right. So the resistance spectrum is troubling, you know, especially in the targeted therapy arena, but now with immunotherapies being in large scale clinical trials, we are seeing some patients developing acquired resistance there. I think what that tells us is kind of what we've known all along. Cancer is a really complex disease, and there are now some very creative co-targeting approaches or co-dosing approaches that are being utilized in clinical trials, for example, to combine multiple checkpoint blockade therapies, to combine a vaccine with a checkpoint blockade therapy, and to combine a targeted therapy with a checkpoint blockade therapy, etc. You know, this may lead us to some interesting answers, and I think that remains to be seen, but you know, we know historically that in cancer therapeutics, drugging with two drugs typically gets a better response than just a single therapeutic. So in some ways, acquired resistance isn't super surprising. It's just disappointing and tells us that we have to try harder.
That's really interesting. I think it'd be good now to turn to funding. And so there's been a lot of coverage recently about moonshot projects. How does that approach compare to conventional funding? What are the implications and advantages of these respective streams of funding for researchers, but ultimately for the patients?
Right. So the Moonshot Project is an interesting beast. I think that to some extent it's a little bit speculative, my answer, because we still don't really understand how this is going to shake out. But, you know, it's becoming more clear over time. Certainly the intent of the Moonshot, as I understand it so far, is as a specific set-aside. So this won't dip into existing funding mechanisms, but would be truly a set-aside on the order of $800 million or so of federal funding to begin to fund specific, innovative, maybe some high-risk, high-reward type programs, but with an accelerated timeline. So in other words, what can you do in 5 years that used to take 10 years? And how is that going to be meaningful for cancer patients 5 years from now? Now, if you're a cancer patient today, 5 years seems a long time away, and that's fair. But I think even the remarkable advances that we've seen just over the past 10 years have really changed the course of and outcomes for many cancer patients. So to me, the moonshot is just a potential doubling down and acceleration of even that very rapid time frame.
Has the acceleration of clinical cancer genomics at select leading centers, such as your center, led to increasing disparities both within and between countries in terms of access to targeted therapies, new immunotherapies, or other precision oncology approaches?
So I travel quite a bit in terms of going to foreign countries as well as around the U.S. I do think that the application of much of what's known in cancer genomics right now today, no matter what country you're talking about, really is very, very focused and localized in the academic centers and tertiary care centers where many advanced patients end up in their journey through cancer care. And so in some ways, these are the most sophisticated sites that can develop and administer these types of advanced next generation, sequencing based tests, and also have available and open the clinical trials for those patients that have a clear indication so that they can sign up for those trials. I think we all agonize a little bit over the fact that if you don't have the time and money to travel to those types of centers, regardless of where they are in the world, and get that type of testing and that type of access to clinical trials, that these are really the patients that are being left behind. But I think we can't be too anxious about that just yet until we've really got things well figured out, until drugs are FDA approved and then accessible by anyone. I think the biggest problem in this equation, no matter where you're at in the US or otherwise, is really the number of trained oncologists who understand the data from these tests and really have the capability to interpret those data into a treatment program for that patient, even with FDA-approved drugs. So we really have an education gap that we need to fill up, not in doctors that are being trained today in these types of centers, but actually doctors that have been in practice for some time. So that's a hard problem to solve.
So my next question picks up on this issue of clinical trials, and it's a key step in translating these genomic advances into clinical benefit for patients that is these clinical trials. And has access to clinical trials become more important, and how do patients get involved in clinical trials with these new approaches?
Well, I think the patients of today are certainly not the patients of 10 years ago. The internet is a very powerful thing, and I'm approached routinely, even as a I'm not a physician, I don't practice medicine, but I do get cited on the internet a lot, and I think I get a lot of outreach from patients who are internet savvy. They're looking for directions, they're looking for help, they're looking for advice. So I think that's been the big differentiating factor. However, we do know from published stories in the literature, from published studies rather, that a small number of patients actually going through some sort of panel or multi-gene test have a clear indication of a potential therapeutic vulnerability. And even when that exists for some 25 to 50% of patients, let's just say for the sake of argument, some significant proportion of those patients, as I mentioned earlier, simply don't have the wherewithal to travel long distances to get onto a clinical trial to get that drug, even if the drug is available, for free as part of the clinical trial. So, that's probably a harder problem to solve in a large country like the United States than it is in a smaller country, but I think it's still a very tangible problem and limits the accrual and the study completion, which at the end of the day is really the most critical factor, because as studies accrue, as patients get the drug, as they respond or don't respond, et cetera, all that data accumulates much faster, and that ultimately will result in the drug either being approved or not so that more people can access it. So it's a complex equation, I think, to say the least.
I think my final question sort of touches on that point of clinical trials and patients accessing it. So the costs of clinical cancer genomics, targeted drugs, and new immunotherapies are high. Is this increase in costs sustainable? How will approaches to this situation differ between private and public healthcare systems?
This issue you've touched on in terms of the cost of medication is a very challenging one. In European countries, in the UK, there's more of a negotiation capability between the governments who largely run healthcare and the, pharmaceutical companies. And so this is a bit, I don't want to say less of a problem. It's a manageable problem in some ways, although still these drugs come through at a relatively very high cost. In the United States, with our private payer system, it's significantly worse. And you do see patients on occasion, for example, taking out mortgages on their houses and things like that just so that they can pay to get drug when the insurance company is unwilling to pay for it. So I think that's a pretty sad state of affairs. I think the other thing that plays into this equation in terms of the cost of the drugs is what we were talking about earlier in terms of the onset of acquired resistance. It's sooner in some patients than it is in others. And as we get away from monotherapy, I think this will improve. But certainly when you go to combined therapies, now you're paying typically 2x what the cost of the drugs would be. And so that's not a perfect equation either. I guess my biggest hope in this scenario is that drugs that were new 10 years ago, such as the initial tyrosine kinase inhibitors that were used in lung cancer for patients who at the time we didn't know why they responded, but actually respond because they have EGFR mutations, were just approved as what's called first-line therapy for these patients. So that means they don't have to go through chemotherapy and radiation and then recur in order to get the drugs anymore. If they have the mutation, upon diagnosis, they can actually get the drug in the first line. And I think this will be very enlightening in 2 to 3 years in terms of telling us whether patients that get targeted therapies straight away actually have less likely possibility of developing acquired resistance. Mm-hmm. And if that is indeed the case, then I think some of this argument about cost effectiveness of these drugs, which is really what we're talking about at the end of the day, may actually be ameliorated somewhat. And in some ways may actually improve the time to first line in many of these therapeutic approaches above and beyond the 10 years that I just described for tyrosine kinase inhibitors.
Well, that's been great. Thank you for talking to us about this, Elaine. We've covered cancer genomics, clinical trials, the relatively new and fast-moving field of immunotherapies, and what this means for patients, and it's been very informative. Thank you. And now for my interview with Mark Ledagny, the Chief of the Molecular Diagnostics Service at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Centre. I asked him about the field of cancer genomics and how the Cancer Genome Atlas, the TCGA, and the International Cancer Genome Consortium, the ICGC, have influenced the testing and the clinical management of cancer patients, and also what role cancer genomics has had in understanding cancer causation.
Hello, Mark. Thank you for joining us on this podcast recording. We wanted to talk about cancer genomics. So our first question is, how do you see cancer genomics in the post-TCGA and post-ICGC era?
Well, I think the TCGA and ICGC have really provided a foundation for cancer genomics. But it's important to remember two things. These projects were focused on primary untreated cancers. And of course, as large as they were, they did not encompass the full spectrum of human cancer. Certainly they included all the major common cancers, but there are many other varieties of cancers that remain to be studied in depth. So in terms of their focus on primary untreated cancers, one way of looking at it is, again, it provides an important foundation to understanding these cancers. But if you think about it, patients do not die of their primary untreated cancer. They die of a treated, relapsed, metastatic cancer. And the genomics of that cancer are often different from the primary untreated cancer. So I think there's still a lot to be learned from studying these cancers at later stages in their natural history.
So does that mean that the TCGA and ICGC data sets in regard to these cancers almost act as a sort of template for these cancers, but actually the study of how these cancers respond to treatment is where the real interest and potential for developing therapeutics lies?
Well, I think it provides guidance for the initial treatment of these cancers, to be sure, and it provides a template upon which these cancers then accumulate additional mutations during their history in each individual patient. And these individual additional mutations can be important in understanding how to best treat advanced cancers of the type that will ultimately kill the patient.
And do you think that genomic testing of tumors will become part of the routine management of cancer patients? It's not, we're not there yet, are we?
We're not quite there yet. It's something that's being piloted at a number of, you know, large cancer centers throughout the world. But I do think that in some form it will become part of the routine management of cancer patients in the same way as the understanding the type of cancer in terms of traditional histopathology is a part of the routine management, as well as performing the studies, the imaging studies and so on to assess the extent of spread of the cancer in a given patient. Just like those two pieces of information, I think we'll want to know the key mutations and other genetic alterations that are present in that patient's cancer before treatment decisions are made.
And what about germline cancer predisposition genes? When will routine testing of these occur in cancer patients, if at all?
Yeah, I think this is a question that's being brought to the forefront because many cancer predisposition genes are also somatically mutated in tumors. And in the course of sequencing them in tumors, whether you use the patient's matched normal DNA for comparison or not, you have the potential of detecting germline mutations in these cancer predisposition genes. So this question is really being, once again, pushed to the forefront because we are generating this sequence information that is available to assess a patient's personal future risk of cancer. Of course, in a cancer patient, that patient already has cancer, but more importantly also for family members who carry the same germline mutation. So I think it's a discussion that's occurring at a lot of centers that are doing more and more upfront tumor sequencing. And I think we're going to see an evolution in thinking about this type of germline screening for cancer predisposition.
Mm-hmm. And where do we stand in targeting mutations affecting epigenetic control?
That's a very interesting question. More and more cancers are being defined or characterized by frequent mutations in epigenetic regulators of various types. And there's a kind of a contrast in terms of being able to target those alterations compared to, for instance, mutations in genes that encode receptor tyrosine kinases. So in cancers that have kinase gene mutations, we're much further along in terms of being able to identify the mutation and match it up to a appropriate targeted therapy. In terms of mutations in epigenetic regulators, the field is not there yet. We don't have a whole menu of specific inhibitors that would target those epigenetic regulator mutations in a very specific fashion that we also would understand biologically. I think one of the first examples, of course, are the IDH inhibitors that target IDH1 and IDH2 mutations, but we actually don't have many other examples of that kind of targeting in the cancers that are defined by these epigenetic mutations. So I should add, I feel that there's actually tremendous potential in this area for further development. And I think a lot of people are very focused on that right now in terms of both pharmaceutical companies developing specific inhibitors and investigators trying to understand the biology of these mutations, which is much more complex in a way than the biology of activating mutations in kinase signaling proteins.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Stepping back a little bit from treatment, how do you see the role of cancer genomics in better understanding cancer causation?
Yeah, I think this is another very interesting aspect that has emerged from large-scale cancer genomic studies, which is the definition of highly recognizable and specific mutational signatures, several of which are clearly associated with specific etiologic factors such as tobacco smoking or UV exposure through sunlight and other even more specific carcinogens. And one can foresee two things. One is that we get a better understanding of the proportion of specific cancer types that are attributable to those etiologic factors. And in the individual patient, we can also potentially better understand, you know, what was the cause of the cancer in that patient. So I think it'll provide a much more sophisticated understanding than we had before. For, you know, much more sophisticated than just automatically associating lung cancer with tobacco smoking or skin cancer with sunburns.
So we've talked about the TCGA project and the ICGC project, and those sequencing projects have been ongoing for a number of years. What was the turning point in cancer genomics from the clinical point of view?
Well, I see the turning point as predating those projects. To me personally, the turning point came in 2004 when the EGFR mutations in lung adenocarcinomas were discovered. This was a couple of years after the discovery of BRAF mutations, but the difference there was that for EGFR mutations, there was already a very specific targeted agent available. And so this paradigm of pairing a specific mutation with a specific targeted drug was available in lung cancer immediately. And this was the first major common cancer where this could be implemented. The paradigm had been shown with imatinib in BCR-ABL-positive chronic myelogenous leukemia, but that was generally viewed at the time as a kind of a special case that might not be replicated in other cancers. But with the discovery in 2004 of EGFR mutations in lung cancers, this changed everything.
And should lung cancers from smokers be tested for mutations that are seen in lung cancers from never smokers?
There has been a real evolution in this thinking in this particular clinical scenario, which, because lung cancer is such a major common cancer and so lethal, it comes up very often. I think what we've learned from studying lung cancers from both smokers and never smokers is that it is possible for smokers to get the same types of mutations as never smokers, albeit at a much lower frequency. But when they do have those mutations, then they have, for instance, EGFR mutations, then they do have the option of being treated with EGFR inhibitors, which are much less toxic than conventional chemotherapy. So we've really moved away from this initial kind of notion that we could use smoking history to exclude patients from genomic testing.
Your institute, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, runs lots of clinical trials. Can you tell us about how advances in cancer genomics has changed the type of trials that you run?
Well, I think the fact that we're prospectively studying patients with advanced cancer using a large panel of genes that are sequenced has really enabled huge expansion of our clinical trial portfolio. And the reason is that this is so powerful is that we basically are able to pre-qualify patients for trials. And by that I mean that instead of having a situation where a drug company has a very exciting new inhibitor that targets a very specific mutation and then comes to us and says, oh, we would like you to profile the next 500 lung cancer patients in the hope that we might find five patients with this particular mutation that could be targeted by our new drug, they're able to come to us and we can look in our records and see that we have already identified 10 patients with that particular mutation. Possibly five are eligible to go on a clinical trial. And so we can very quickly pre-populate these very specific targeted therapy trials. Another way that this also works very nicely is in these trials that are called basket trials that are primarily focused around a particular genetic mutation that can be targeted, regardless of the histologic diagnosis of the tumor. And the individual baskets in these basket trials are, you know, for instance, if it's a BRAF V600E mutation, then there's a basket for colorectal cancers with that mutation, another one for lung cancers, and so on. And the patients can be enrolled on these trials as long as they have the right targetable mutation, regardless of the type of cancer. And this has really been very successful here now that we have this very broad mutational profiling of patients when they first come to our center for treatment of their advanced cancer.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thank you, Mark. That's been very interesting, and you've provided us with some key time points and dates where the genomic data has influenced treatments of cancer patients. That's very helpful.
I hope you enjoyed my interviews with Elaine Mardis and Mark Ladany. Don't forget to submit to our Cancer Genomics Special Issue by Friday, July 8th, and be on the lookout for the special issue later in the fall. The PLOS Medicine podcast is made by PLOS, the Public Library of Science, a non-profit open access publisher dedicated to transforming how research is communicated. This show is produced by Jen Laloup and edited by Will Jackson. I'm your host, Claire Garvey. Get in touch with us by email, plosmedicine@plos.org, and follow us on Twitter @plosmedicine. Thanks.